Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, Taylor Milliner finds out more about Kid Zorro, a bilingual puppet musical. That's coming soon to all four San Bernardino Public Library locations. It's starting April 22nd. We have Jonathan Linden in conversation with John Cameron, editor of EDM.com, breaking down various types of electronic dance music. We're going to start with a book addressing ways to simplify one's life and gain more from it. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
Joining us today is author Courtney Carver. Courtney is speaking with us today about soulful simplicity, how living with less can lead to so much more. Thank you for joining us today, Courtney.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm glad to do it. Your new book has a lot of good stuff in it for helping people who have been through some things in life. You write about some tragic events in your life that was to culminate for you with a wake-up call. But before you tell us about that wake-up call, will you share with us what your life was like before your divorce and finding out about multiple sclerosis?
Sure. Well, I think that I was living like a lot of people do, very busy, very stressed out, very deep in debt, generally overwhelmed with everything that I felt like life was throwing at me. Instead of pausing and trying to figure out what was going wrong, I just made myself busier so I didn't have to face the pain of that overwhelm. But I would also kind of look around, and everyone seemed to be running at the same unsustainable pace that I was. So I thought maybe this is just what adulting is all about.
Do you think that most of us come to that realization at some point?
I think many of us do, for sure, some sooner than others.
Yeah.
But if we don't come to the realization, our bodies do and let us know.
So that's part of the wake-up call for the rest of us, right? Now, as sad as it was, your marriage ended. You had a daughter that you needed to protect and raise. You received by phone a diagnosis of having multiple sclerosis. How did you come to realize that you needed to change things in your life? And what were the most important things to attend to first?
Yeah, when I was diagnosed with MS in 2006, that was really my enough is enough moment. I didn't think that my lifestyle had caused the disease, but I knew the stress in my life was certainly contributing to symptoms and exacerbations. I mean, not immediately, because most immediately I was sad and scared and didn't know what to do, but pretty quickly realized that I could be an advocate for my own health. And that was certainly the most pressing issue, was getting my health back. And all the research I did pointed to reducing stress. And so that is what I set out to do, reduce or eliminate as much stress as possible from my life.
Right.
One thing at a time.
Now, Courtney, before we move on, will you take a moment to share with our audience where they can find out more information about your book and your website?
Sure. Well, the book, Soulful Simplicity, is available at most bookstores, so hopefully at your local bookstore.
Okay.
And then also at online retailers and wherever. You can find it almost anywhere, and libraries as well.
All right.
And then my website is bemorewithless.com.
Okay, will you briefly share with us how you started that website, Be More With Less?
I started the website in 2010 after I had had a couple of years under my belt of simplifying and de-stressing.
Right.
And I wanted to share what I was learning and connect with like-hearted people who may be feeling overwhelmed too and form a community.
Okay. Now, in order to bring about this soulful simplicity that you speak of in your book, you had to learn some new ways of thinking and rearrange some old ways of, well, love, responses, and thinking. How did you do that?
Well, I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't have a plan. I really, to be honest, just kind of dove in and started making small changes and was open to the lessons that I had to learn along the way and still in the process. And I hope I always will be in the process of, you know, letting go and being open to the things that are meant for me now.
I'm curious as to when you spoke about raising your daughter and giving her this and giving her that and doing all these things for her, what changed for you in helping her to learn how to de-stress and grow up without all those things? As far as helping her to grow up, you had to realize that what you were doing was going to lead her into the same type of lifestyle at some point?
I didn't give it much thought in the early days. Again, everything was kind of on autopilot, and I was just trying to keep up and do what I thought was best. Once we did start to simplify and change, I mean, what I did for her, because she was, you know, probably preteen when we started paying off our debt and decluttering, I was changing my job situation. Instead of, you know, making her do things around it, like making her declutter her room or her closet or having really big conversations about the debt, she watched. You know, we let her watch what we were doing. And I think that so often that's how kids learn best, is by seeing us walk the walk versus hearing us talk the talk, so to speak.
So your daughter was blessed in the fact that she actually got to see her mother less stressed out, more joyful about her life simply by making these choices.
Definitely, definitely. And I mean, I was really fortunate too, because, you know, I had time while she was still young and living with us to enjoy her as much as I could. And not that I didn't enjoy her and love her so much before that,
right,
but I didn't have the space to be as present as I was once I started to get rid of all the excess.
Now, how do you get rid of all the excess? Because we have, again, so many things that are so important that the whole world is going to fall apart if we don't do them. How
did
you do that?
Well, the easy answer is we get rid of them thing by thing, inch by inch, day by day. So it's not an overnight, you know, oh my gosh, I'm just going to get rid of everything, even though you will get to a point where you probably want to do that.
Yeah.
But consistency matters so much more than intensity. And what happens is at the very beginning, there are things that you look at and think, I could never let that go.
Right.
But because you take your time and you start with the easy things, like the picture frames that don't have pictures in them, or the duplicate sets of measuring cups, or the 50 coffee cups you have. And I promise I'm not coming after your coffee. Maybe right. you don't need as many coffee cups. And then when you get to experience that space that you've created and the benefits that come along with it, the other things that you thought were so important don't feel so important anymore. And so it's this kind of gradual process of letting go.
And that actually makes a lot of sense. Speaking about that, you talked also about building routines, and especially having a morning routine.
I'm a big fan of the morning routine because for me, it allowed me to remind myself that I came first. I come before my email. I put myself first. Before the errands, before rushing out the door. When I first started this practice, this morning practice, I didn't have a lot of extra time. My daughter was young. I was driving her to school in the morning and going to work. But I had 5 minutes. I could make 5 minutes. And even that was enough to reconnect with myself and eventually to remember who I was and what mattered to me. So not only was I navigating my days more easily, but my life was shifting overall because of that consistent practice.
Wow, so you were building structure and order in your life. How is that working for you now?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, this has been many years now, and as my life situation has changed, so has my morning routine. So where in the early days it was 5 minutes, now it's usually a couple of hours that
wow.
I spend meditating, reading, taking a walk, doing yoga or working out, and really taking great care of myself before I take care of anything else.
Wow, that was so relaxing. I could have just went on and took a nap right there. But okay. What about spontaneity? Is that something important to foster also?
I don't know. No one's ever asked me that before. Uh-huh. I can tell you that I'm not a super spontaneous person. You could probably gather that from the book. I'm not a big fan of surprises either, but I really love lingering and enjoying a moment, a good book, a cup of coffee. I like to travel. Spontaneity may be important for some people, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it might not be important for everyone. And I think that's kind of part of this whole process, is really learning what is important to you, what matters to you, and fostering that within your life.
Okay. Now, here's a big question for you. What was shopping to you, Courtney?
Shopping to me, before I simplified my life, was a pain reliever.
Ah.
So, yeah, it was the easiest way I could dull the pain of boredom, of disappointment, of heartbreak. I could shop that away like nobody else.
Wow.
But it didn't last. I mean, I'm sure you know the end of the story.
Like, yes.
By the next day or the next week or when the credit card bill rolled in, that temporary high of acquiring something new.
Now, what are some of the mental and physical things that we have in common that clutter our lives in all aspects that should be given attention and adjusted where need be?
Wow, I don't know if I have enough time to answer this question.
Well, there's
so many things, ironically. But I think one of the things that we do is we worry a little bit too much about the future. So we get nervous about uncertainty and what's coming. And so we hold on to things just in case, whether that be physical things
right.
or ideas that we have or work that we're not crazy about, when in reality, like, no amount of worrying about what's coming next is going to change that.
Right.
Or we get stuck in the past and we don't make change because of a failed change that we had in the past or because someone said something to us that really stuck with us and we think that we're not confident enough or capable enough or whatever it is. I think that's probably the biggest part of mental clutter is not having the presence of mind to enjoy where you are and
yes.
to make decisions from where you are.
Now, as you said, though, our time is running short, but at the end of your book, you say a simple life is not the end goal. What is the end goal for people wanting to reduce the complications that many of us have accepted?
Yeah, there's so much hype around simplicity and decluttering and capsule wardrobes and having a simple life, but I didn't declutter and reduce stress and remove busyness to have a simple life.
Right.
I did it to have a life.
Ah.
So we're doing this to get our own lives back.
You have learned that loving yourself in right measure leads you to make choices that keep things more simple than complicated. In learning this, have you now perfected life? Or is stumbling sometimes something to be expected?
Oh my gosh, I've definitely not perfected life.
Okay.
I don't know if that's even possible because it is always changing and I'm always changing as we all are. So I think we need to all be a little more open about our stumbling and our imperfections because it is our imperfections that make us perfect for each other. It's our imperfections that inspire each other and give us permission to just to be ourselves and,
yeah.
and not to have to live up to this picture of perfection.
Wow, I really like that. It's our imperfections that make us perfect for each other. Okay, I'm going to go climb a mountain after this interview and tell that guy who's been sitting there all these years that he was wrong. But thank you so much for joining us today, Courtney, and sharing about your book, Soulful Simplicity. It is a great book.
I appreciate your time.
You are more than welcome.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Courtney Carver, author of Soulful Simplicity. More at bemorewithless.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. As KVCR continues, Kid Zorro, a bilingual puppet musical. Also, EDM, electronic dance music, trying to sort out just what's what. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we have Jonathan Linden in conversation with John Cameron, editor of EDM.com, sorting out for us the variety within electronic dance music. First, we have something rather fun on the way to several libraries soon. Here's Taylor Milliner in conversation with Angela Encinas, children's librarian at the San Bernardino Public Library.
Kevin Noonchester and Noteworthy Puppets will be presenting Kid Zorro, the bilingual puppet musical, at all four city libraries. Can you talk about Kid Zorro, the bilingual puppet musical?
Zorro was a famous character in the movies. And anyway, this is a bilingual puppet show that takes place in Spanish California. And it's about the masked outlaw who helps the poor and the down and trod. they have to save the local mission against the corrupt politician. It's a musical, so they're singing throughout the storyline. It's Zorro and the girl, of course, is the girl in the story, and how they're trying to help everybody.
Perfect. That sounds fun. Are kids coming from school, or are their families bringing them?
We're hoping to get school and also families to come. It's for both. So we're trying to contact the schools, but the local school right now isn't available. They're doing a special program themselves, so...
Got it. Hopefully this will help.
Yeah, hopefully this will help.
Exactly. So when and where will these programs be held?
At the Feldheim Library, Tuesday, April 23rd at 10:30 a.m. at the Big Wong Auditorium. But we're going to have him also at the other branches at our system. So on Monday, April 22nd at 5 p.m. at the Via Senior branch. And then also Tuesday, April 23rd at 5:30 p.m. at the Roe branch. And then finally on Saturday, April 27th at 2 p.m. at the Ingram branch library.
Okay, perfect. And then did you see it last year? Can you tell us about how that show went?
It went great. The kids were laughing and having lots of fun with it. It's funny. It's also comedic. So you laugh. And he has a wonderful voice. And he plays both the female part and the male part.
That's so funny.
And the singing was great. I thought it was outstanding, in my view. I'm not much of a singer, so.
Wow. Okay, perfect. And then how exactly did the kids react? What did they think?
They were laughing. They got the jokes. And they got, when the mean villain came on the scene, they knew, you know, they booed and all that kind of stuff. Usually, yeah, just they knew who was the hero and who was the villain of the story.
Mm-hmm. Do you know any of the kids' favorite moments, whether you spoke to them or heard from their teachers or parents, perhaps?
I think one of the favorite moments was when Zorro was hiding who he was from the girl, that he was just a local peasant boy of the village.
Okay.
And then, you know, that was funny because you could tell who it was. You know, he was Zorro, the same person. But somehow she couldn't tell the difference. You know?
Got it. Okay. What about you as an adult? Did you have favorite moments from this musical?
My favorite moment was when they were both singing together.
Singing together?
Yeah. Somehow he would sing a part and she would sing the chorus or whatever. That was my favorite part of the show.
He accompanied himself?
Yeah, he accompanied himself.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So he was really good.
Wow. I'm probably going to have to come and see it.
Yeah, he's very good. He's very professional.
He sounds professional.
Yeah, like he's had lots of experience.
Exactly. Okay, so then listed in the title, a bilingual puppet musical, are there separate performances between English and Spanish, or is it a mix of the two, like a bilingual performance?
It's a mix of the two. He's switching between Spanish and English.
So it's like a Spanglish type of...
Yeah, Spanglish, right, yeah. Or he'll say it in English, and then he'll say it in Spanish.
Got it.
The same word.
That's funny. And then what age group is this musical aimed at?
I would say probably kindergarten up should be able to follow the storyline.
Got it.
It's a fairly simple storyline. So.
Okay, so pretty much anyone can really watch
it. Anybody
can,
yeah.
And enjoy. Okay, is the musical interactive at all?
No, it's not interactive at all. It's just a straight puppet
Got
story.
It. Okay, so this will be Kevin's second year performing at this location. How did he come to perform at the library previously?
He was here in October, I believe, for a special program. We saw him at a performance showcase. The libraries usually have like a performance showcase where you get to see all these performers before everybody books for the summer reading program or for any other special programs during the year. And that's where we saw him and we met him there.
Okay. And then I know that this musical is revolved around Dia de los Niños. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, it's commonly known as Dia. And it's a celebration of children, families, and reading. So sometimes it's called Día de los Niños / El Día de los Libros. And it culminates yearly on April 30th, usually. So during the month of April, or maybe beginning of May, you have special programs. And the idea is to celebrate the importance of literacy for children of all different backgrounds, linguistic and cultural backgrounds.
That's interesting. I love that. What is the significance of the musical? What is he trying to teach or bring awareness to?
About justice and, you know, if we all unite together, we can stop people who want to do things wrong for your community. It's about the community and saving the mission that's important to the whole community. And that if we unite, we can actually do something about it.
Are there any programs in the future that the public should know about?
Well, the summer reading program is starting June 1st, and that's for children and teens and adults. Everybody's invited. So they sign up, they get a special bag. They get to get prizes. It's for reading.
Okay.
For the children, it's for reading, coming to events, and doing some special activities. Same for teens. And for the adults, it's about checking out books, and they get to be their own special raffle, and they get prizes.
And that starts on June 1st, you said?
It begins June 1st and ends July 27th.
Okay. And then for more information on that, how can people contact you?
They can call me at 381-8250, and I'm here every day.
Thank you so much, Angela. I really appreciate talking to you.
Hey, thank you very much.
That was Taylor Milliner in conversation with Angela Encinas, children's librarian at the San Bernardino Public Library. More at sbclib.org. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Up in just about a minute, EDM, electronic dance music. We'll hear from John Cameron, editor of EDM.com. To KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Now, with the music in the background at the moment, you may think techno, house, EDM, that stuff you hear at raves. It is EDM, electronic dance music, but within this broad umbrella, there are several subgenres. Sorting it out quite nicely, here's Jonathan Linden.
Today we have John Cameron. He is the managing editor of EDM.com. Thank you so much, John, for coming on to the show today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
The first thing I want to ask is, what is EDM?
So EDM, there's one kind of perception of EDM that it's all electronic music, and that would be kind of a more recent perception of it. But that's sort of like saying that all hip-hop is rap. Like, all rap is hip-hop, but and all EDM is electronic music. But that term really, even though it's been in use in some circles for a really long time, it really became popular around 2007 or so, when promoters like Gary Richards wanted to rebrand electronic music and take out the negative stereotypes associated with rave culture. So that's when you really saw this term be popularized. And that's the point of controversy between kind of the more tenured fans, the fans who've been into it since the 90s or in some cases even the 80s, and the newer fans, which are only kind of familiar with this one wave of it. So I think that the best definition I could give of EDM is that it's the period more than it's one genre of music. It's kind of a period of different electronic music that kind of became popular in the mid to late 2000s. And it's still going pretty strong. It's on the decline a little bit, but it's still going pretty strong.
Would you say the kind of like overarching kind of name for it would just be like, oh, this is electric music? Is that kind of an accepted term even with like the old and new?
I would say the more universal term, like the internationally recognized term, would be electronic music, in some cases dance music. It's obviously kind of ironic that the term everybody doesn't like is sort of just a portmanteau almost of electronic music and dance music. But given that people have been using the term and then they don't really want it to be redefined, and there's sort of this cultural inertia there, it kind of makes sense.
So one of the main goals I wanted to do with this interview was kind of talk about different genres and give people a better perspective of what is electric music? What is EDM? Because I, like you said, there's a lot of misconceptions. So within like EDM, what would be like kind of the current term, like the newer genre, I guess you could say, what falls under the EDM sub bracket, I guess you can maybe say.
Sure. Well, first of all, I think just to clarify something, it's usually referred to as electronic music, not really electric music.
Okay.
But I would say that under the EDM umbrella, so there are genres that are under both umbrellas, at least genre descriptors. Like progressive house has a different meaning in kind of traditional electronic music than it does under EDM. But some of them that are more specific would be big room. Like big room is a very specific, like it's a derivative of house music, which is obviously one of like the original electronic music genres. But big room house is a very festival-focused style of house music. There's also trap music. Dubstep is another one that straddles the line between the old and the new. There's this old dubstep that sounds a lot closer to garage, which is a style that kind of came about kind of parallel to house music and then grew really popular with the advent of UK garage. And recent dubstep is much different. Recent, it kind of evolved with laptop DJ culture and everything. It started out as dub played a two-step garage, which is how it derived its name. And then it kind of became a lot different, a lot more aggressive because of laptop DJ culture. And that's kind of what people think of now when they think of dubstep. They think of, you know, this really aggressive, like almost like heavy metal kind of music. And then also there's genres like trance. Some trance kind of falls under both categories and everything, and some electro. But yeah, I would say genres like trap and big room are really kind of the genres you think of when you talk about EDM.
And would those be the genres that are played at big festivals that are happening around the U.S.? Or
yeah, they're definitely, there's in this kind of a hodgepodge sound. There's kind of like it's gone far enough along and been commodified enough that people are kind of shooting for this sound that's sort of like how there was a Clear Channel sound that kind of came about in the radio, similar to that in the festival circuit and on like streaming platforms. There's sort of this sound that is sort of like draws from future bass, which is like another EDM genre, actually, from future bass, from big room house, things like that. And it's just sort of this middle ground sound that appeals to everybody just a little bit.
Okay.
And which, you know, the industry always tends to do. It always finds kind of ways to pull in as many people as possible.
Yeah.
So that would be like a really big sound right now.
So I want to jump into like what was the beginning of the electronic music genre as itself? Do you know kind of like the history of the roots of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are sort of different versions of that, sort of nationalized. There's one narrative, a very popular narrative, that kind of cites the U.S. as being the birthplace of all the music that we think of as, you know, popular electronic music. And house music did come from Detroit. There is a venue called Warehouse in Chicago where Frankie Knuckles played. Frankie Knuckles is widely considered the godfather of house music. You know, when they would release these records in record stores, they took out Ware and they just called it house music. And that's kind of where the term is derived from.
What would you define as house music?
It's a 4-4 beat structure. So it's just boom, 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 boom. No syncopated beat or anything like that. It was originally house DJs were originally disco DJs who just specialized in something that you would call a tight blend, where they would take out certain parts of the track and emphasize more danceable parts. And then the original house release, a lot of people consider that to be Your Love by Frankie Knuckles, which featured Jamie Principle and was mostly written by Jamie Principle. The difference there, like kind of the turning point there, was that that's when synthesizers became incorporated into house music.
Okay.
So it was basically this evolution of disco that incorporated more synthesizers. Obviously, Giorgio Moroder, who was a big disco producer, used some, but incorporated more synthesizers and just took it in that direction, that natural evolution.
And is the house genre still around today, or...?
Oh yeah, certainly. House has maybe the most different subgenres. There's progressive house, there's acid house, there's future house, there's big room house.
Is there a...
the most permutations of any of the popularized dance music genres.
Is there a specific artist that sticks out to you in current times that is very successful in house music? Or
one, that's tough to say. I mean, one maybe right now, Mark Kinchin, MK. He's a really popular house artist right now. He actually originally worked with techno artists. So techno is kind of like House's shadow almost. It came about like 5 years or so after, at least it was termed, it was the term for it was coined about 5 years or so after house music in Detroit instead of Chicago. And one of the originators of it, Derek May, Mark Hinton actually used to work alongside Derek May. Now he works with hip-hop producers, all kinds of stuff. A lot of dance music producers also work closely. They do production for hip-hop artists, for pop artists, things like that.
So you kind of mentioned techno. So what's kind of the history behind techno, and how does that differ from house music?
Sure, absolutely. So the history behind techno is that there were, you know, Detroit and Chicago are only 4 hours apart, and there were artists who were starting to take house in kind of their own direction and everything. And this is another part, another thing where there's sort of a narrative that publicists may or may not have crafted a little bit to kind of serve their needs. There were three artists who were widely credited as being kind of the originators of techno. They're called the Belleville Three. Their names are Derek May, Kevin Saunderson, and Juan Atkins. I had the pleasure of interviewing all three of them the first time I went to Movement, actually. And basically, techno, and this remains true today, it was always a little bit more sterile, a little bit more synthetic. It sort of emphasized the artificiality of dance music, whereas house still tried to kind of, even though it was synthesizer and drum kit based, it kind of tried to mimic some of the organic sounds of disco a little bit and things like that. And where the term techno came from, so this is one big, actually, point of contention. According to Juan Atkins, he came up with the term techno from a book called The Third Wave by a futurist named Alvin Toffler. And there, it was basically, Toffler had speculated that there would be this movement of people who would reject technology, and he called them techno rebels. And that's where Juan Atkins got the term. That being said, there were Germans who were using the term techno for a style of music that was kind of similar to industrial, kind of similar to EBM, electronic body music, back in the 80s. And that predates techno. So, and Juan Atkins did derive a lot of influence from German artists like Kraftwerk. So that's another one where, kind of based on what nation is kind of crafting the narrative, it's kind of hard to say where the term came from. But it has always kind of defined that sort of, like I said, house in the shadow. It's a little bit darker.
What were some of the other countries that have been influential in kind of shaping the electronic music culture? Because it's just not the U.S. There's been other countries that have made, had artists that have made significant contributions, correct?
Absolutely. I would say that a lot of the origins of the music that caught on, you know, sort of parallel to the information revolution, originated in the U.S., but they really didn't catch on very big in the U.S. They caught on much bigger in the U.K., and people kind of considered the U.K. to be the capital of dance music for quite a long time. And then around 2004 or so, that sort of shifted over to Berlin. And there's also a lot of influence, although it's honestly not as recognized in the Western world, but there's quite a lot of influence from Japan and the Japanese pop scene and things like that.
So the next thing I kind of want to talk about is, what is Big Room in future bass? What is different with those genres compared to house and techno? How did those kind of create their own path?
So one convenient thing about electronic music is that the definitions are very clear-cut, very easy to put in musical terms what the definitions are. So in the case of Big Room, similar to house, has a four-on-the-floor beat structure typically. So usually in the case of Big Room House, it's like the name implies, it's made for bigger rooms or festivals. So the drum kicks are going to be harder. It's going to rely on what you would call layered synths. So typically it's layers of some permutation of the Hoover synth. The Hoover synth is something that caught on in hardcore and then was also used a lot in trance in the 90s. And then a lot of the big synth leads in Big Room songs are kind of based on layered versions of that original synth that kind of caught on in popularity. Think of the Hoover synth as the electric guitar of electronic music.
And what is trap?
Trap, that has a syncopated beat. It's very much inspired by hip-hop. So originally, the term trap, and this is another place where the term kind of changed meanings, trap was music like Atlanta hip-hop artists like T.I. And it became kind of adapted by electronic music acts. It basically, it's more instrumental hip-hop. It's less about the lyricism, less about, you know, the verses, and a lot more about just the sound. And about kind of almost also like the physical experience of music. That's one distinguishing factor with electronic music, is that in a live setting, it's very, very much based on the physical experience of the music and how you feel the bass in your body and things like that.
Yeah, so those tend to be very always bass heavy, correct? Or
yeah, and there is more melodic trap. There is melodic trap out there. That's kind of what future bass is a lot of the time. At least what it derives a lot of influence from.
Okay.
But yeah, trap in general is going to be a lot more bass heavy.
Would you say there's any mainstream electronic music artists that aren't as bass heavy? Or?
Oh yeah, certainly. I mean, obviously all music has to have bass frequencies in it. There's no music that just is devoid of that.
Yeah.
But there is music where the bass is emphasized less. Well, first of all, ambient is very kind of arbitrary in terms of beat structure and everything, but that's not really a popular genre, so that doesn't really answer your question. But things like techno, the bass line is important, but it's not the be-all and end-all of it. Techno is a lot more about percussion nowadays. It is. Techno has meant a lot of different things in 30 years. Like I said, big room house, the kick drum is important, but it's kind of still very dependent on there being a memorable melody. So ironically, even future bass is a little bit less bassy than regular trap.
Before we did this interview, you had sent me kind of like what you defined as pre-EDM, post-EDM, and then you had a third section you called for both pre and post. You said electro, trance, and dubstep. Why would you consider those both?
Well, because those all originated before what kind of that turning point that I talked about, where EDM started to be kind of marketed as the new term for this music. And then also sort of changed the course of how it was experienced, how these events were promoted, things like that. So in the case of electro, I mean, electro has meant so many different things. It used to be the type of music that it was very popular in Germany around the same time house was. And early hip-hop artists actually delivered their verses over electro back then. And then it changed meaning very much over the years. And now, obviously, it's groups like Knife Party who are a lot more about that sort of high energy. Electro now is very similar to big room. As for dubstep, yeah, dubstep originally started out as being very similar to, well, it was, like I said, played a two-step garage. That's where the name comes from. So it wasn't this super aggressive style, but it was a lot more kind of, and it did have dub influences, like influences from dub reggae and things like that. So it was a very different sound than it is nowadays. And nowadays it's like about headbanging and stuff, kind of like you'd think about heavy metal being. So a current example of dubstep would be like Excision. That's probably the leader in that space right now.
Okay.
Older dubstep would be artists like Scream, artists like Zed Bias, people like that.
You've kind of mentioned this throughout the interview. You talked about how there have been people who have tried to change the perception of people that are into electronic music culture. What has been that process, and what were some of the perceptions that people have had, and what have people been doing to try to change that?
Well, I don't know that they're trying to change the perceptions of people in the culture as much as they're trying to change the stereotypes around the culture, and the biggest one being that it's all about drugs. And yes, the drugs are part of the culture, and I would be lying if I said that they maybe didn't have a little bit bigger of a part in the culture than in other genres. Like I've talked to event medicine professionals who say that the rate of drug use at electronic music festivals is much higher than that of other events. So just to be realistic, it is probably kind of a bigger part in the culture. At least certain types of drugs are. Like alcohol is a much bigger part in other cultures, but drugs like ecstasy and cocaine would be bigger parts of rave culture. But basically, you know, there were legislations passed. There were kind of big sort of media circuses around electronic music back around, like, oh, the early 2000s. Obviously, there was the Rave Act in 2003 that really pushed it back underground a lot.
What was the Rave Act?
The Rave Act is actually part of the Homeland Security bill that it actually is a little bit draconian, really. It's kind of controversial. There are people who they basically passed laws that said that if you were an event promoter and people were selling drugs at your events, you could be held accountable for facilitating that.
So that was that was controversial. And how did that affect the industry at all? Or
yeah, it sure did. Things got really pushed underground for a while. Around the turn of the millennium, electronic music was. There have been very many different points where electronic music kind of permeated to the masses, and then it got pushed back down again. Since so much of it is derived from disco, it's kind of like when disco died in the 1970s, but over and over again and over again and over again, kind of a cycle.
So, John, we're a station based here in San Bernardino, and so there's quite a few festivals that happen at an amphitheater here in San Bernardino. And there has been a lot of controversies, like people who have passed away at those events. Like, how does the community respond to those types of things?
In regard to deaths at dance music festivals, I would say there have been more of them as the events have gotten bigger in capacity recently. Like, there were obviously incidents that early on in like early raves and stuff that kind of gave, that were a black eye on the whole thing. But honestly, the reason for deaths at these festivals, a lot of the time, while it may have been exacerbated by drug use and things like that, they're usually a lot more due to dehydration and due to like overcrowding and lack of security at some of the festivals than they are just due to drug overdoses on their own. I interviewed Mitchell Gomez about that from Dance Safe. It's a nonprofit organization that actually gives out free drug test kits at shows and educates people. That also is kind of controversial. There are people who would argue that that facilitates drug use in itself, but their whole cause is harm reduction. And he was telling me that addiction rates are not higher among dance music fans, but the rates of accidental overdoses at like festivals where it's maybe like much hotter out than normal events and things like that, those are more common as the festivals are getting much bigger. And they're trying to figure out how to direct a lot of the foot traffic and things like that.
What are some of the biggest festivals that are happening here in the U.S.?
Here in the U.S., EDC is probably still king of the mountain.
EDC, that's in Las Vegas, right? Or
Yeah. It was originally in SoCal. And after the death of Sasha Rodriguez, which is a 16-year-old attendee of Electronic Daisy Carnival at the L.A. Coliseum in 2010, they were no longer able to have it in SoCal, so they moved it over to the Speedway, to the Las Vegas Speedway, and that's been its home ever since. Shortly behind that one would be Ultra Music Festival in Florida, maybe Electric Forest in Michigan behind that.
And
those would be some of the big ones.
Do you know much about the festivals that are happening right here in Southern California? Like, what are some of the significant ones happening in SoCal?
Sure. So Insomniac, who puts on Electric Daisy Carnival in Las Vegas, they probably have the biggest kind of hold over the SoCal market. They put on events like also like Beyond Wonderland. Nocturnal Wonderland, actually, even though EDC is their flagship event, Nocturnal Wonderland they've held since a few years longer, since back in 93, I believe.
Well, and that happens in San Bernardino, right? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it does. It happens at the National Orange Show Event Center, yeah.
And so Electric, it also has an international presence. Are there some bigger festivals that stand out on an international scale?
Yeah, certainly. So internationally, the biggest one would be Tomorrowland in Belgium, put on by a company called ID&T. It extends over 2 weekends. That one's an EDM festival that still has a lot of presence for things like house and techno. There are very big techno festivals abroad. I would say kind of other than Tomorrowland, the biggest electronic music festivals or techno festivals like Awakenings or Sonar or things like that.
So is techno more of the dominant genre outside of the States? Or
I'm going to go ahead and say yes. It has the most downloads on Beatport, Beatport being the biggest download store for electronic music. And it's hard to say with live music. Polestar doesn't do a whole ton of metrics with electronic music and stuff like that, so it's a little bit harder to say with live music which the bigger ones are for kind of event capacity and things like that. But generally, yeah, I would say Awakenings is probably kind of, aside from Tomorrowland, which itself also has a lot of techno presence and house presence, I would say maybe Awakenings would be the second biggest one.
A perception that you might hear from people outside of people who listen to electronic music would be that maybe it isn't real music, that it doesn't really take as much talent, that people are just pressing buttons and things on their computer. What would be your response to that type of comment?
Sure. Well, so a couple points. First of all, would you say the same thing about a maestro just because they're not playing an instrument themselves? Now, electronic music has made the barrier of entry for musicians much lower, but when somebody does it well, there's a very perceptible difference in the sound quality. And just because more people have the tools to make something like that doesn't mean that it's less music or that it's any less of music. And the other thing that I would say about that is that dance music is a lot less about the individual making the music, and it's a lot more about the collective experience of the music. So there are a lot more people involved. There's the DJ who plays songs that are made separately by the producer, and there's the party promoter who, you know, goes to great lengths to set up good sound and everything to make sure that the experience of the music is very important, you know, and that's kind of the thing that defined DJing and remixing culture from the very beginning. It was a lot less about just this, you know, this individual person making this artistic statement, and then after every song, they just kind of hang out for 5 minutes and look cool until their next song, you know. It was much more about there being a seamless transition from song to song, and the collective experience of the music being made the priority rather than just the creative statement of the individual. So I don't know that it's any less music, and you could argue that it's a little bit more manufactured in some ways, and
yeah,
it's obviously made for dance floor utility and things like that, but in a way there's almost more of a purity to it.
Yeah,
that it's more about the experience than it is about the individual.
And a lot of these festivals, yeah, it's just not the DJ standing there. They have like video in the background, lighting, correct? Or like a lot of DJs are utilizing a lot of aspects to make it a better experience, or?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that obviously falls on the promoter a lot of the time. In very traditional circles, it's still very much about the music, but it's, you know, in dark warehouses where the DJ is kind of tucked away in a corner and there aren't a million lights on them. They're not posing and singing along with the songs the whole time. It's way more about them kind of guiding the musical experience, but it's a lot less about them.
Do you have any other comments or things that you would like to say to someone who is still very new to the genre and just the topic of electronic music?
It all sounds the same. It's all terrible. You shouldn't listen to it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, John, again, for coming in. If you want to check out some of his articles, he has a ton of cool stuff on EDM.com. And thank you so much again, John.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, no worries.
That was Jonathan Linden in conversation with John Cameron, editor of EDM.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KBC Arts. Thanks once again to John Cameron, Angela Encinas, children's librarian with San Bernardino Public Library, and to author Courtney Carver. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Watt, Jonathan Linden, Emmanuel Rogers, Taylor Milliner, Rebecca Ward, Alyssa Lanier, and KVCR General Manager Tony Papa. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVCR's programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.